first case for argument this morning is appeal number 07-3826, Hugh Quick versus Aurora Loan Services. Mr. Comey.
Good morning. I represent Avdo Hukic, a immigrant to the United States from Bosnia, who finds himself before your honors in a case where he was victimized by the defendants over a period of time concerning the servicing of his loan for the mortgage on his residence. The defendants brought him into state court, and when they brought him into state court claiming he had defaulted on the mortgage, when it was discovered that there was a decoding error or a key punch error.
How did that happen? This $200 decoding error, as you...
Well, I assume a human being punched the buttons on the machine.
Money orders are not the usual way people do business these days, but he was paying his mortgage monthly with a money order, as I understand it.
Like a clock.
So he goes someplace and he buys a money order. Wherever, I don't know where you go to buy the
change.
Where?
Currency exchange.
Currency exchange. You buy a money order.
You tell you're talking to a wealthy man. He never used a money order.
No, I used to use money orders. Unlike Judge Bauer.
Well, he's a man of the people who's been to a currency exchange.
Yeah. I go to for those payday loans, Judge Bauer. he gets a money order, and it's apparently in the correct amount.
100% correct.
And now what happens? Who inputs that, or how does the $200 error occur?
The money order gets mailed to the mortgage servicing company or the bank that originally issued the mortgage. When they run it through their system, they decode it in for $200 less than the face value of the money order.
That's the mortgage holder that did that, made that error.
Right. Goes in there. Gets deposited in their account. Then it runs through the Federal Reserve System completely. It gets returned to the currency exchange, just like you get your checks returned. So there's a record that he had paid it in full. Under terms of the Uniform Commercial Code adopted by Illinois, that's satisfaction completely of the obligation under the contract for that month.
On the bank's, the mortgage lender's records, though, it shows a $200 shortage for that particular month.
Yes, sir.
And then that just carries through here. Every month he keeps paying, but this $200 keeps building up.
Right, but then
and
they sell it.
Default, according to the bank's records.
Right.
It just seems like it's such a simple, or should be, a simple situation to rectify an error like that.
Probably on the day you graduated college, the day you graduated college, you could have walked into your local bank, showed them a copy of it, and it would have been resolved. But these people aren't in Illinois. They're somewhere else. They collect the mortgage somewhere else. There's no longer the intimate connection between the bank and the community. So this check sails out into the stream of commerce, gets cashed.
But here's the problem I have. The language in the loan agreement says if the borrower makes these payments directly, the borrower shall promptly furnish to lender receipts evidencing the payment. So we didn't have a situation where your guy could walk in and show it, like to your local friendly bank. But why didn't he comply with that requirement, that is, showing evidence, you know, the records and all that, that showed that he had actually paid it? He never did that.
He was on the telephone with him. The comment logs, which were finally furnished in discovery 3 weeks before when they were finally legible. In the first instance, they turned over illegible documents. When we finally got the documents, we could see he was on the telephone talking to them about the discrepancy.
Exactly. But he never furnished them a copy of the documents.
Well, he sure did in the circuit court, because in the circuit court, the judge found he had proof.
Exactly. He did it in the circuit court. I'm talking about where Judge Evans raised the issue of how this could have been avoided totally. And also, I'm looking at the language of the agreement. So maybe one way it could have been avoided was before he goes to circuit court to provide the written documentation showing it had been paid.
Assuming you're correct, they then file a mortgage foreclosure action in the circuit court. Once they filed a mortgage foreclosure action, he files a motion for involuntary dismissal, proves all the money orders attached to the motion that they cashed and collected. He shows that, and then they come in and they say, well, you didn't pay the real estate taxes, furnishes proof to the court, and the court involuntarily dismisses their case. So at that moment in time, they were on notice they were wrong.
How does the lender know that he was paying the property taxes personally?
In the way you get a mortgage now, you can get a mortgage where you agree not to have to pay monthly.
Not the escrow.
Portion, and then it's your responsibility to pay it. I've had my mortgage now for 27 years over on Larrabee, and I have never had to furnish proof. I've just kept on paying the property taxes to Cook County. I think it's...
Be careful.
Well, I haven't been foreclosed in 27 years.
There's where property taxes are.
So I want to get back to my question, though. All this documentation that he provided once the mortgage foreclosure action was filed could have been provided before anything was filed.
And if it had been demanded, yes.
But then they did demand to have evidence of the payments, right? And as the agreement said, to promptly furnish the lender receipts evidencing the payments. So all these things could have been done in advance and could have complied with that language.
Right.
And would have complied with the language, correct?
It certainly would have had he, you know, been asked to do so by the bank to furnish the proof. But there was no issue about furnishing that proof prior to getting to the circuit court. Once it got into the circuit court is when their attorney said, well, where's the proof he's paid? But prior to coming to the circuit court, the whole argument was over the $200. And what they did then is they tacked on what they call hazard insurance, which is basically insurance for the house. He had proof that he had insured the house elsewhere through Allstate, so that the place had been fully insured throughout the time. And what we discovered once we got our hands on the logs was that the people involved in the mortgage company itself were paid substantial bonuses for defaulting people and causing them to lose their homes, and that scheme had been exposed in the Texas court. And once we got the names of these people, we were able to find out through the Internet that the case had been tried down in Texas, and that's when we came in to amend the complaint in the district court, is when we learned that there had been a scheme internally to reward people for taking people's homes away. So that we then tried to amend the complaint to bring that to the court's attention. But at the time that you're asking about in the circuit court, the sole issue was, had he paid his mortgage on time? The complaint talked about paying the mortgage on time. There was nothing in the circuit court up until the time that the involuntary dismissal was filed about a question about real estate taxes. And they ended up being double paid. The lender went ahead and issued checks on its own for the real estate taxes. And Mr. Hukic cooperated with them getting a refund. But my point is they then had the right at that moment to correct all the problems. At that moment, they had a judgment from a judge. They didn't appeal it. They didn't take it up. It was a judgment on the merits. So they knew he was in total compliance with the obligations under the mortgage because they could not get a default under the Mortgage Foreclosure Act of Illinois. The problems in this case are what happens after he leaves the circuit court. Because what becomes the issue in the subsequent lawsuit is the continued publishing of him as a deadbeat in the credit reports. Plaintiff's complaint here is all about what happened after he left court. And I personally wrote a letter, which is in the record, telling him to correct the credit report, and they did nothing after we left the circuit court. I have represented Hukic all the way through all steps in this case. And it isn't until after we leave the circuit court that the continued publication disturbs Mr. Hukic enough that he starts complaining because he can't get other loans. He can't refinance. He's paying the highest rates possible for his credit. He's being ripped off by their continued publishing him as a guy who didn't pay his mortgage when, in fact, he actually did in the immigrant fashion. With cash every month on time like a clock. And then he comes to court and he files in the circuit court a complaint alleging that they're destroying his reputation concerning his credit and he's entitled to a day in court. And what happens? Well, they file a removal within 30 days, but they don't actually come clean with the court as to all the facts that are required to do a removal. They don't clearly identify Aurora Brothers Bank as a...
That's on your jurisdictional objection here, but you had a claim in the complaint under the Federal Fair Credit Reporting Act. Wouldn't that give the district court jurisdiction even without diversity considerations?
Well, as I understand these statutes, they're strictly construed. I haven't been removed often, but I understand when you do it, you must do it strictly, and strictly requires a full spelling out on the removal document of every fact necessary to establish jurisdiction. And there's a 30-day window to correct technical defects, but once you pass that 30-day window, technical defects are no longer correctable. And then on top of that...
I just don't see the technical defects here.
Well, in this case, they failed to completely disclose that Lehman Brothers Bank was a federally chartered bank and that it was a nationwide citizen, which in turn means...
They contest that in their supplemental jurisdictional statement that's been filed.
Right, but they only had 1 year
diversity,
to correct that problem.
Isn't there federal court jurisdiction in the case that alleges a cause of action under the Federal Fair Credit Reporting Act?
I don't believe so, because they had a 1 year window when they could have amended, and they never did. And then they try to hang themselves on a statute that was amended more than 1 year after the event took place, which was the removal itself. So if you're looking at the two statutes in question here, the first statute says they have a maximum of 1 year. In that 1 year, they took no action to correct the jurisdictional removal papers, and they have not corrected them within the 30-day period. So there are two opportunities.
In your rebuttal time.
Oh, thank you for pointing that out. Any more questions before I excuse myself?
No.
Thank you.
Mr. Brooks?
Morning, Your Honors. May it please the Court. Brian Brooks for Defendant Ocwen Loan Servicing. With me today is Mr. Emanuel, who will be representing Aurora Loan Services. Your Honors, if it pleases the Court, I would like to touch on subject matter jurisdiction and the issues that are addressed in Section 1 of our brief. These are the issues we characterize as procedural issues, one of which is the District Court's treatment of the foreclosure judgment. Let me begin, if I might, with a couple of moments on the issue of subject matter jurisdiction. Judge Evans, as you point out, in the notice of removal, the original notice of removal filed in August 2005 by Aurora, the Federal Fair Credit Reporting Act is invoked as a ground for jurisdiction. There's no issue of an amendment. There's no issue of untimeliness. 28 days after service, Aurora removed the case and invoked the Fair Credit Reporting Act and specifically said in the notice that the Fair Credit Reporting Act may be brought in federal court. So there's no question that federal question jurisdiction was first invoked at the time of removal. 5 days later, in Ocwen's timely filed consent, Ocwen specifically noted that 1331 is the jurisdictional statute that covers Fair Credit Reporting Act cases. End of story, so far as we're concerned. To the extent that diversity matters, Your Honors know, I think, from our 28J letter filed in response to the jurisdictional paper that appellants filed last week, that the law of thrift citizenship in the United States was changed in 2006 in an amendment to the Homeowners Loan Act. And what the amendment says is that federal thrifts, like Lehman Brothers Bank FSB, are citizens only of the state where their head office is located. It is undisputed that the head office of Lehman Brothers Bank is in Delaware. It is also clear as a matter of Supreme Court law in the Landgraf case that that amendment to HOLA applies fully to this pending action. And so diversity jurisdiction exists. We don't think there's a serious dispute on that unless the court has questions. Let me turn next, if I might, to the district court's treatment of the foreclosure action, in part because of the questions that the panel had with counsel a moment ago. First of all, Your Honor, it is clear from the record, and you will find the citations in our opening brief, that the issue of the escrow arrearage, not the issue of the $200, was the basis for the foreclosure proceeding and was central to the foreclosure judgment as entered by Judge Billick in Cook County Circuit Court. What is clear is that in 1999, before any foreclosure case was ever commenced, Aurora notified the plaintiff that that funds had been advanced for property taxes as permitted by the note, both to protect the borrower's interest in retaining his property and to protect the lender's security interest. As a consequence, Aurora notified the plaintiff that an escrow account had been set up for him as is expressly authorized by the note, and that the amount of his monthly payment had now been increased to satisfy the arrearage for the funds that had been advanced on his behalf by the servicer. That's undisputed. It is also undisputed that Mr. Hukic continued to make payments not at the increased rate required under the note to satisfy the escrow arrearage, but at the original contractual rate.
Had they any idea that he was paying the taxes himself?
There's nothing in the record to suggest that anyone at either of the two defendants knew that fact. Now, it's quite possible that Life Savings Bank, a predecessor to these two entities, Life Savings Bank's not a party in the case, might have known something or might not have known something. Say, but here,
he had not been paying the taxes up to the time they sent the notification of his new escrow. Am I correct?
That's exactly right. And the reason for that
was, when they decided to start paying it, they didn't bother looking to see whether he had been paying him all along and kept on paying.
Well, Judge Bauer, I would contest that characterization.
Did they know he was paying them all along?
No. That answer is clearly no.
Didn't know?
Right.
Well, in that case, the taxes would have been in arrears, wouldn't they?
Precisely so. And indeed, there was an arrearage. That's what happened in 1999.
How did that occur?
What the record shows is that a tax bill was received.
By whom?
By the servicer, at that time by Aurora. Aurora, having no evidence that taxes had been paid, advanced those funds on behalf of the borrower.
This is the original lender.
No, this is the second servicer.
The original lender didn't pay the taxes. He did.
That's our understanding, right. And so what happened?
The second one received this. They knew that he was paying the taxes.
They were not. What happened was this, Your Honor. The loan got transferred to Aurora for servicing.
Yeah, okay. And there's no escrow showing in the original loan.
Correct. There's no escrow showing at all.
So somebody's been paying the taxes all along, and if there's no escrow, the assumption would be the landowner is paying the taxes.
Your Honor, with respect, I don't think there is an assumption on that.
Why shouldn't there be? Somebody had to be paying the taxes. They weren't. Somebody else had to, and it wasn't in arrearage.
Well, in fairness, Your Honor, the language of the note sets up what the default rule here is. And the default rule is, we will pay your taxes. That's what the note says. And then the note says, if you're going to pay the taxes, it is your affirmative obligation to notify us. Now, could you change that rule? Sure. Notes could be renegotiated.
But that's the original.
Statute could be passed.
That's the original note, you mean?
Well, there's only one note. The note is transferred to Aurora for servicing and later transferred to Aquin.
But the original note says, we're going to pay the taxes. There's a difference. Well, he did pay the taxes on that original note, didn't he?
Nothing in the record about that. Could well be. It's quite possible.
Is there any real dispute that there was no tax? Nobody foreclosed on the taxes.
Right. Yes, it's not an issue in the case. We've never taken that position,
so
and they haven't either.
You knew when you got it that he had been paying the taxes because there was no escrow in the account received.
Judge Bauer, the reason I tussle with your hypothesis is all Aurora knew at the time the loan was transferred to them was that the loan was transferred with a particular current status going forward. And so then the question is,
would they have purchased that loan if the taxes had been in arrears for some years?
They didn't purchase the loan, Your Honor. What happens here is that owners of loans, in this case Wall Street investment houses, like we've all been reading about in the papers.
The owner were in trouble. Go ahead.
Exactly. Yeah. So what happens is a Wall Street investment house who owns the loan assigns it to servicing, almost like you're hiring an employee to do that job for you. And so you assign it to Aurora, and Aurora's job is to do what the note says. So when Aurora gets a tax bill from Cook County, it looks to the note, and the note says Aurora, or whoever the lender is, in this case Aurora as assignee, will pay the taxes. There's no dispute that Aurora immediately notifies Mr. Hukic of that fact and immediately identifies the amount that is owing. Mr. Hukic doesn't dispute that, nor does he make the payment. And as a matter of controlling state law on that issue under the Voiles case that we cite, his failure to dispute that and his failure to make good the arrearage means that the reporting of the significant arrearage, which is a default, is not error. The bottom line is, Your Honors, and I realize my time is up, so I'll sit down. The key point about these state court decisions is on their face they make clear not that he was current, not that there was not a default, but that he and Aquin had reached an agreement to reinstate based on his cure of the arrearage. If that shows anything, it shows that there was a default, not that there was not a default. And Judge Kendall's interpretation of the face of that ruling was pretty clearly correct in our view. Unless the panel has questions on limitations or the other issues I mentioned, I'll defer to
my colleague. You'll hear from Mr. Emanuel now.
Thank you, Judge.
You're going to talk a little bit about this $200.
May it please the court,
Robert. Just seems to be, it's amazing to me how this happened.
Well, the $200 issue is something that a plaintiff has focused on at great length, but that is not what caused the ultimate default and foreclosure here. I appreciate Your Honor's question earlier as to why he did not provide proof of that during his deposition. Mr. Hukic indicated that he was simply too busy or that it was not his problem. I would note that proof was requested repeatedly by Aurora Loan Services, but ultimately what...
And that proof was requested before the mortgage foreclosure action.
Yes, and I believe...
In writing.
I believe that is correct. And I also believe that's in the record. But what caused the foreclosure was the failure to pay the increased amounts due under the note in mortgage. Mr. Hukic's payments increased. These issues could have been addressed back then.
If you put the taxes aside and you just talk about this $200, which continues to roll over as this note gets older, how much was that? What's attributable to that?
I don't know how much it ended up being, but I think what's important here is there never would have been a foreclosure. None of this ever would have happened had Mr. Hukic paid the amounts due under his note mortgage. He would have been treated as a late and would have been treated as 30 days late every month. And there are ways that you can contact a servicer to address those issues.
But
those
says
weren't
he
done
contacted
here.
Him 15 times within the first 5 months and 36 times during the time that Aurora was servicing the loan.
That is what he says. There is a statute that applies. RESPA has a provision that provides for addressing these issues with a servicer. It was not utilized here. And... But at the end of the day, we come back to the question, what triggered the current controversy? And that was the foreclosure. And that was not a result of the $200 discrepancy that counsel focuses on. It was under your note and mortgage, you have to pay the amount that is due. He was asked to provide proof that he had paid his taxes. Our records indicate he did not provide the proof, and then his payments increased, and he simply refused to pay the increased amount. Again, there were ways that he could have dealt with this. They weren't invoked here. And then many, many, many years later, we end up with this lawsuit in federal court. And unless Your Honor has further questions on the $200, I was going to talk about the FCRA issues, if that's something the court's interested in. First of all, I think from what we've said, we certainly think that the court correctly concluded that the plaintiff was, in fact, in default under his mortgage. And there is also a preemption basis for disposing of the contract claim. FCRA Section 1681S2 provides for preemption of certain state law claims. The way you get out of that is by arguing that someone intentionally violated the Fair Credit Reporting Act, that they did it willfully or maliciously. When we took Mr. Hukic's deposition here, we specifically asked him, did you think, or do you think, perhaps, that this was done intentionally? And he said, no, I believe this was a mistake. On those facts, where someone has said he doesn't think we acted with intent, the Fair Credit Reporting Act then preempts state law claims, and the court properly dismissed the contract claim.
Well, after he notified you that there was a mistake, or notified you, after that it was intentional, wasn't it? assuming the first problem was a mistake, once he's there on notice from him on the telephone calls that everything that's not true with their original premise, aren't they now acting intentionally after that?
I don't agree with that characterization, Your Honor.
How would you characterize it?
They just
ignored him?
Well, if you look at the record, he contacted us apparently, I'm not sure when, but well after the foreclosure in perhaps 2004. I don't have the date in front of me, regarding the Fair Credit Reporting Act. But what he is supposed to do is contact the credit reporting agencies. And that's very, from our perspective, very clear under the law.
We're talking about knowledge and whether or not they acted willfully and intentionally, and that has nothing to do with the Foreclosure Act. It has to do with what knowledge they had when they were doing what they were doing.
I'm not exactly sure what your question is, but I think your question is if they did not...
If they knew they had made a mistake, and it wasn't intentional, once they found out they had made the mistake and they continued the same position, that's intentional.
Your question assumes that they knew they had made a mistake.
Well, didn't he call and tell them they made a mistake?
He called and said that he thought they had made a mistake.
They didn't check to find out.
They disagreed with that characterization, and they sent him a letter explaining exactly what they thought had happened with respect to the loan processing, but with respect to the credit reporting. At that point, they had no connection to his loan whatsoever. The foreclosure was complete. The loan had been sold to someone else. For those reasons, we think that the district court opinion should be affirmed unless the court has additional questions.
Okay. Mr. Comey.
I think in the appellee's portion, you've identified the 36 phone calls, the multiple phone calls, the communications between Mr. Hukic's agents and the mortgage servicer. They knew there was a problem before they even filed the foreclosure. They were on notice there was a problem before the foreclosure was filed in the circuit court.
Those Do you acknowledge that he received those written requests before the mortgage foreclosure action, asking for proof of payment?
Right, and his agent provided proof to them. And the testimony in the Texas case from Guzman, the secretary responsible for receiving that, was that they just tossed those proofs of payment into a filing cabinet and did nothing with them. Now, if we'd been able to amend the complaint and been able to bring that before the district court, there might have been an entirely different outcome with respect to this matter, because at the time we were trying to amend the complaint, there were no dispositive motions on file. We were, you know, within a reasonable period of time, we were within a few weeks of finally receiving legible comment logs that we could actually read and identify people's names so we could start checking on things. We were confronted with a stony wall of impenetrable stone until we had to come in on a motion to compel even to get legible copies. So, I mean, at this particular time, once we had that, we were able to move forward. Going back to my colleague's suggestion that there's a federal question here, if we look at document number one from the district court, the removal notice, it is based on diversity of citizenship, not on federal question. Federal question was not in the original notice, and they claim that there was more than $75,000 in controversy and that citizens of different states were involved, so that there was no federal question raised immediately within the 30-day period, nor within the 1 year, so that we believe that the district court didn't have jurisdiction on this particular removal. Mr. Hukic stands before this court today asking for his day in court and justice. It seems, based on the arguments both in the district court and here, everybody gets caught up in what happens before the merger of judgment. If the doctrine of merger of judgment means anything, when the judge in the circuit court of Cook County concluded the mortgage foreclosure action had no merits, no basis for the judge to even grant a judgment in favor of the plaintiff in the circuit court, at that moment we have a complete merger of judgment. Every issue that was existing prior to the date of that judge's judgment was rendered obsolete, moot, and resolved by the judgment itself. And the problem was we didn't get full faith and credit downstairs on the circuit court's judgment on the merits. And we should have had full faith and credit, and a district judge shouldn't have been trying to untangle a circuit court judgment which clearly said they were not entitled to foreclosure on their claims concerning potentially real estate taxes, hazard insurance, or even the $200 payment. And it is mind-boggling how a $200 mistake in the beginning, which everyone becomes aware of over phone calls, communications, proof of payment to the mortgage service company from the agent, and then we end up in a court where a court finally decides the question, and then the district court below attempts to undo what the judge did in the circuit court. I stand ready to answer any other questions you may have. It's been a pleasure being here after being sworn in 1976 by Luther Swigert. It's a pleasure to come back. I always enjoy returning.
Okay, thank you. The case is taken under advisement, and we'll proceed to the